looking at for over a year in Marylebone High Street. And the thing that made that sort of a catalyst for me to get into journalism much more was because we as a newsroom, I mean, we was quite a big newsroom. We had something like 20 researchers and reporters to cover any story in London that the news editor wanted to. We also had a very good news editor, a guy called, what's his name? James Cameron, and his girlfriend was a news producer. It was a very tight-knit unit. They were really into beating the competition and also definitely had a public service ethic. It was also an interesting period. We'd have, for example, there was an IRA bombing campaign going on in London. So I got to see the way that was reported. And the thing that made the BBC and radio in London an interesting place to work is simply because we got the first bite of the cherry of any story in the city that became publicly known about. So you get your TV journalists have got one method of getting their information. You've got the newspaper journalists, much slower, maybe more considered, but in radio we would get the first bite of the cherry. Just to give you an example, when the stock exchange bomb happened, I think it was in 1990, we get an announcement in the newsroom, there's been a bomb at the stock exchange, it was whatever, about 9 o'clock in the morning, and there were various, suddenly people are taken off of stories and put onto this news story, and really the way the public are going to get their information first is going to be from us. And this is one of the things that I always think, if there's a terrorist attack of some sort, that kind of event, it's really important, I think, to be listening to the broadcast news at the time. And that's why I've mentioned George Orwell's quote in beginning of my presentation here, which the quote, exact quote is, "He who controls the past controls the future, he who controls the present controls the past." Now, there's a great deal of effort, in my experience, goes on into controlling the debate. And I think we're in a situation now in Britain with the media in fewer and fewer hands, mostly commercial hands, the influence of people like Rupert Murdoch, where that debate actually, for the first time, really can be controlled. You can't control the sort of speculation that happens in pubs about what really happened. But none of us are very close to news stories. They're all either the other side of the world, the other side of the city, or the other side of the country. So we're really relying on those journalists to tell us what's going on. Effectively, particularly the broadcast media, and now with the internet too, this is the nerve system of humanity, right? If you think of humanity in this sort of Gaia principle or whatever, you've got the nerves sending messages around, and if you're getting false information, how can the whole body politic react correctly, for example, to something like ISIS, you know, which happened last summer. So, so with the stock exchange bomb as a good example, what we could do was simply somebody like me get on the phone. I knew a guy that worked in the city. I phoned him up. I said, have you seen anything about the bomb? He says, no, but I know there's the Royal Bank of Scotland around the corner, which looks out over the stock exchange. So I got on to directory inquiries, as you used to be able to do in those days, and actually got hold of the number for Royal Bank of Scotland, phoned Royal Bank of Scotland, and we got somebody almost straight away who had a perfect view of the scene before the police had even arrived. So with radio, what you can do is you can just switch that person onto a live broadcast. I think it was somebody like Johnny Walker was on at the time. I flagged this up to the news editor. We got someone who's got a view of the scene. And so we gave a running commentary of the scene at the stock exchange as the police were turning up, putting up their cordons and that sort of thing. Now, none of the other media could really get so close to the immediacy of the event to describe it. Now, obviously, the problems then come afterwards when there is a lines spun by the police, etc., as about what's happened. But at least you can get an initial honest view of what's going on there. I mean, I'll talk about it in a minute, but I then got very irate. Personally, I felt annoyed about the way the 7/7 London bombings were covered, partly because having covered the IRA bombing campaign, I could see that the journalists weren't being honest with people. In fact, I interrogated some of the journalists and found out that was quite true. They weren't being honest with people, not necessarily their fault, but the nature of journalism has changed in the digital age massively. I suppose the biggest change really is with the demise of the trade unions. I mean, I'm a member of the journalist union myself, but you can see how with new technology that Murdoch brought in with the Wapping dispute in the 1980s, that technology now is taken out of journalists' hands. In the old days, if you talk to journalists from the 90s, who worked in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, you'll find there was a very strong demarcation between the journalists and the printers. The editors wouldn't even necessarily get involved at all. So a journalist would write a story, like me, would write a story, and would take it to the hot metal people, the people who actually would lay up the print page, and there would be a line, you know, so the journalist had to stay one side of the line, the printer the other side of the line. What you'd do is you'd give the guy your story. Once he'd laid up the page, he would then call you back. You would read the story back to front because it was then in hot metal, and you'd make sure that story was what you'd written, and then you'd sign that story off. So the editors didn't get involved. It was just basically the print unions working with the journalist union to produce a newspaper. Nowadays, it's completely different. So a journalist will submit a story digitally, maybe from their home, and then that will go through a process of editors, sub-editors, etc., be put into a desktop published into a page. That page will appear in a newspaper. So there's all sorts of opportunities to interfere with what the journalist was trying to say before it ends up in the newspaper or it ends up on the internet. Just one example from last week, the Daily Telegraph, which I don't always get, but the front page of the Daily Telegraph, there was a story about David Cameron saying, party members urging Cameron to keep to his promise of only two terms, right? But actually, if you looked at that on the internet, as I then did on my phone, you'll find actually the headline, the story is basically the same, written by the same journalist, but the headline's been completely changed to there are people urging Cameron to drop his promise of three terms. They want him to stay, to fight another election, another general election. And so you can see that there's been lots and lots of changes in the way that those stories are actually, so you might go to the internet. If you get there a few hours late, you've actually got a different story to what the journalist originally intended. So there's been some very, very deep changes in the way that we get our news with the digital age. In Bristol, we did a debate earlier this year, and you can find it online, between two top West Country journalists. One guy is Phil Chamberlain. Phil's a senior lecturer in journalism at the University of the West of England. And Phil has just done a fantastic book, and I would ask everybody to check it out in the library or even buy a copy, called Blacklisted. And it's all to do with the blacklisting of construction workers. This is the situation where somebody reports, say, for example, someone that nearly gets killed on a building site, as a health and safety issue, they then get put on a blacklist. They won't be employed anymore. This is going on all the time right now. Companies like Kia are doing this, and also the guy who was running this, the central office where the blacklisting was going on, he was due to give a report to Parliament on the Tuesday, and he died mysteriously on the Saturday. So there's all sorts of nasty stuff going on here. Lord McAlpine and the McAlpines are big in blacklisting. So that was one person in this debate, Phil Chamberlain from University of the West of England. The other person I came across who lives in Wiltshire is a guy called Tim Tate. Now, Tim worked for Yorkshire Television back in the old days of doing World in Action, and he worked for First Tuesday, which was another documentary series. And Tim produced what is one of the most shocking things you'll ever see on YouTube, which is a film called Conspiracy of Silence. And it's about the use of paedophilia within the Republican Party, Franklin. And what was happening was young kids who were either in the US care system, didn't have parents that were really, you know, directly looking after them, were being seduced using drugs at parties and things like that, getting hooked on heroin, and then trafficked up to Washington by senior Republicans. There's a place called Boys Town involved in all this, which was some kind of nice boys camp, but actually kids who were going to this camp were being there. So anyway, this is an incredibly powerful documentary. Discovery Channel paid $500,000 for Tim and his team to make the film, and then I think it was about a week before it was due to be broadcast on Discovery Channel, Tim gets a little note from Discovery Channel to say, actually, we've decided it's not really part of Discovery Channel's remit, and we're not going to be showing your film, but here's the $500,000 for it anyway. And that film you can see on online, but you know, the point here is effectively the lawyers and the big media companies are just not there in our interest. They're there to work for largely for shareholders and also for directors who have a very strong political interest. So those two characters we had in the studio in Bristol, because I do a program now on Bristol Community Radio every Friday evening, sort of drive time show, politics program, we're really tussling with this idea of, we had this old system in the past where we had maybe 5, 6, 7 weekly investigative TV documentaries looking into the subjects of the day. Very famous documentaries like Death on the Rock, if you remember that, to do with the three IRA people who were shot in Gibraltar by the SAS. And were we getting lies from senior politicians in Parliament about what had actually happened? Well, it turned out, yes, we were. And so that was the old world. The new world is this brave new world of the internet and digital media, which Tim was saying the old world worked, the new world doesn't. And Phil was saying the opposite. He was saying actually the blogosphere, you can find almost any bit of information you want out from a blogger somewhere. We've now got a democratization of the media, citizen journalism, which has opened it up like never before. And I won't come to any conclusions. Actually, maybe I will come to a conclusion about which one is right, because I think Tim Tate made the argument. He's saying, look, we had teams of 10, 12 people working on a story over a period of months. We also had full-time lawyers, which is very important if you're actually going to get your stuff shown to a wider audience, who were on side politically with what we were trying to do. And we'd built up this, what he calls an ecosystem of investigative journalism in Britain, right across the country. The other thing is that the part of the broadcast licenses back in those days were to do with actually having you had to sign up to do this kind of stuff, otherwise you didn't get your license. That was part of how you got a broadcasting license as an ITV company, for example. To do that was saying, we're going to do this hard-hitting investigative journalism. And there was a genuine competition around the country. We're going to get to the story first. So say once somebody here is a whistleblower and you've phoned up your local journalist, they say, oh, we can't really do that because, you know, or they say they will and they don't do it. What there were was probably something like 10, 12 different places in the country you could go with your information, with your whistleblower's knowledge, and any one of them might turn it into a half hour or an hour long documentary to be shown to the country. Now that's not there. And Tim's argument was simply that really this isn't happening anymore. The bloggers just don't have the resources. Yeah. The other thing is they don't have the journalistic training and the credibility always to present the case and the references that you need to back up a story, to stand it up. A lot of it is just rumour. So, I mean, I think we've lost something very important there with the loss of programmes like World in Action, with the dilution of programmes like Panorama that really don't do the stuff anymore. Actually, there was one Panorama programme earlier this year about Northern Ireland. I don't know if anyone saw it, to do with the British Army's death squads, effectively, where they doorstepped a former general in the army as he's getting into his car, you know, and various other people who were involved in these British Army stroke loyalist death squads. That's the first Panorama I've seen, I think, for about 3 or 4, well, maybe even more, longer than that, many years, that's actually done what Panorama should be doing, which is speaking truth to power and calling corrupt officials, you know, the banksters, for example, to account. So that's, you know, you can look that up online if you're interested. But, you know, it's great, I think, to see investigative journalists of different sorts grappling with this idea of where do we go with investigative journalism. One thing is really the main part of what I want to say today is about these minefield subjects. So there are subjects as a journalist that's working on national or international stories. I mean, I'm now doing stuff with Russia Today and also with Press TV in Iran, which is because it's very, very difficult to get anything out in Britain. A lot of the subjects, I'm interested in these minefield subjects. I want to do stuff about, you know, forwarding the problems with the child sex abuse scandal, which is absolutely appalling miscarriages of justice. Just last week, was it? Last week? Yeah. Tom Hayes, this LIBOR trader, was sent down for 14 years. Actually, he's in a position where he's been in all these major banks. He's actually, when he was at UBS, he was given a manual how to fix LIBOR. So why is it that this guy is the ringleader? What about the person that wrote the manual on how to rig LIBOR? Why aren't they going to jail? Well, the fact is, above his pay grade, and these people are effectively too big to jail, aren't they? I mean, they talk about too big to fail with the banks, but actually, you've got an elite who are above the law, too big to jail. It turns out his boss at UBS, Carsten Kengeter, have you ever heard of him? No, because the media hasn't been doing its job, has it? And Carsten Kengeter has got a nice job now after he was headhunted by the German Stock Exchange. So he is now the director of the German Stock Exchange, even though he was at UBS and in on meetings with Tom Hayes about how they were going to be fixing the LIBOR rates. So that sort of thing annoys me when somebody is being a blatant fall guy. Where actually, what would normally happen in those circumstances? What would you do if you were a judge? Can I ask anybody here? I would say is, this guy can turn Queen's evidence and send down some of the most powerful people in the world, because he's got the evidence that this guy, he spoke to this guy, he's got the manual, etc. Why isn't that happening with Tom Hayes? Why hasn't he been the prosecutors saying, well, okay, if you give us all this information, you can get off and we'll get the big guys. Yeah, but they've not done that with him. He's the fall guy. Interestingly enough, it turns out his dad, Nick Hayes, is a former editor for Panorama and World in Action, which I just was gobsmacked to find that out. And he's just arrived on Twitter, and he's saying a few interesting things about it. But anyway, these minefield subjects. Got to start really with the 7/7 London bombings, because for me, you know, having worked on terrorism before, seeing the 7/7 bombings happen in 2005, I was just coming back from an eco-village gathering actually in Hungary at the time. And first thing I saw when I got back was, blimey, this is interesting. Immediately, Benjamin Netanyahu had been in London, and he changed his plans due to a warning. He was phoned by Amy Teeble, Associated Press in Jerusalem, to say there was a bomb where you were supposed to be going at Liverpool Street Station, BB. Are you okay? You know, and then he said, or someone of the spokespeople, Dan Shaham, we've now found out it's Dan Shaham, this guy from the Israeli embassy, said, oh no, because we got a warning. And so we changed the plans, and so he never left, and so he stayed in his hotel that morning. He didn't travel to Liverpool Street. But hang on a minute, because it was a surprise attack. So how come the Israeli embassy's got a warning, and Benjamin Netanyahu's staying inside the embassy? Where did the warning come from? Well, Israelis say Scotland Yard told us. Scotland Yard say, no, we didn't. So what's going on there? I mean, Dan Shaham also said that the Israeli embassy went on to high security alert at 7 a.m. How did they know? How did they know there was about to be a surprise attack on London? Was it a surprise attack or not? This hasn't been really interrogated. Another aspect to the 7/7 attacks, I mean, I take this seriously, because this is, you know, who has actually carried this out? What do we know about it? One of the things is the CCTV coverage, like with Princess Diana, right? No CCTV of any of these four alleged bombers on the bus or on the tube trains. So there's pictures of them in the booking hall or whatever, but there's no pictures of them getting onto the trains. There's no pictures of them on the trains. But at least if you go into London, you've got CCTV cameras everywhere. John Snow pointed this out on Channel 4 News. I think it was relating to the John Charles de Menezes story, actually. But you go into the station, they were counting all the cameras. There's, you know, whatever, 30 cameras there. You go into the train, there's another one there, but no footage of these guys actually on the trains. Very strange. Anyway, so there were pictures of the trains afterwards. The other thing with 7/7 is Mark Honingsbaum. He was working for The Guardian, and he was actually down at the Edgware Road. He was sent immediately down there. So he was talking to people as they were coming out of Edgware Road tube station. And Mark did an audio report about lunchtime on 7/7 itself. So he spoke into a little microphone, and they put it on The Guardian website. In that audio report, he says the people had been telling him that the bombs were underneath the trains. Now, He may be wrong about that, but it's interesting that he said that on that one of the most immediate things straight afterwards, that this is what people have been telling him. The bombs are under the trains. How can they be? These guys are inside. The other thing is, if you look at the pictures, you'll find that a lot of the glass is has been, it seems, blown in, right? So in a tube train, the windows have shattered, the glass is all inside the tube train. Well, you think to yourself, that's a bit funny, because if there's someone's blowing themselves up inside the train, wouldn't you just think by logic that maybe the glass would blow out rather than in? Possible, but it may mean nothing. But I phoned Mark Hollingsbaum up about some of the things to do with 7/7 a couple of months after the attacks, because I noticed that the article that had been printed in The Guardian the day after, on the 8th of July, he said in this article that it was suicide bombers in the train. So, and I said to him, well, what changed overnight, Mark, between that report you did before and the report you did afterwards? And it's actually very easy to get through to him. Just phoned him up straight away. There he is. And he said, a little pause, and he said, well, how do I put this? Not everything I submit as copy ends up in the next day's newspaper. So that brings questions to my mind about what really happened on 7/7 London bombings. What with the potential Israeli foreknowledge of it as well. The other aspect to all of this is digging into that story. I mean, you know, you just get a journalistic, maybe it's a copper's instinct or something, that something's not right. And looked into the security companies that had been working on the London Underground in the months running up to it. Gordon Brown had privatised the Tube. I think it was about 5 months before the London bombings. And one of those companies is called Variant Systems, another Israeli company. Most people on the Tube don't realise there's an Israeli company running some security system. It's to do with the CCTV cameras. And this company, Verint Systems, I mean, I've got nothing against these people as individuals, but if you look into the company, their parent company is called Converse Technologies. Their chief executive of their parent company was on the run from the American Securities and Exchange Commission, their stock exchange regulators. He'd having absconded with $13 million, and there was a whole load of charges against him in the US. So why on earth is a company being employed to do security on the London Underground whose parent company is on the run from the US Stock Exchange? This guy, Kobe Alexander, escaped to Namibia. Is it Namibia? Yeah. And he stayed on some kind of uranium mine or something for several years until they did a deal with these, paid off the Securities and Exchange Commission. But, I mean, this is not the sort of company I would trust personally to be doing security if quite obviously the top of the company structure you've got criminality going on. I pointed this out to a couple of cops, armed police at Paddington, you know, saying, look, have you looked into this, guys? Yeah. And to begin with, they thought I was some sort of, you know, sort of, I don't know, conspiracy nutcase or whatever. But I said, look, here's the name. Have a look at it when you get back, yeah? And actually what was happening was that their senior officer was trying to poo-poo it, but the actual individual coppers with the machine guns, we will have a look at this when we get back. You know, they were laughing, saying, well, it's not impossible, this kind of thing. Anyway, that's just one thing with, you know, with the London bombings. Having seen Mark telling me how his story was changed from one day to the next day when it arrived into the newspaper, you start to wonder what kind of world we're living in, where newspaper editors and owners, people in key positions in these papers, can actually tweak a news story if it looks like it might go out to the world in a manner that we don't like. Another minefield subject I find is payment technologies. We're living in a very peculiar world at the moment, where lots of the ways do you remember when chip and pin came in? Did anyone ever ask us, do we want to do chip and pin? Do we want to stop signing our name? Isn't that actually easier to do a fraudulent transaction rather than actually, if you've got a signature there, you've actually got evidence that someone's forged a signature? If someone just puts a few little dips into a digital machine, isn't that actually less secure? Isn't it? Now, I got this through from the Co-op Bank. Here we go. Now, with smart, safer and faster ways to pay. Money, microchip and digital ID. Well, look, what's happening slowly but surely is we're being steered down this route into digital money and away from cash and away from ways where we have actually got some kind of anonymity. At least with cash, we've got some anonymity. What's happening slowly, it seems to me, is a sort of, it's almost like a kind of economic cage we're being put in. Every time we spend money, every time we buy something, make a transaction, we're slowly getting to the stage where it's all being tracked and monitored. We're spending money on this, we're spending money on that. That in itself, people might not be bothered about. I am. I'd much rather be doing that anonymously. I don't like the idea of my bank or people who've got access to my bank's software knowing everything that I'm doing or buying and making money out of maybe guessing what I next want to buy and targeting me with marketing, that kind of thing. I think this, you know, if you're going to be doing financial transactions, then it's got to be, it should be really private. Also, as we're moving on to contactless payment as well now, everyone got issued these contactless payment cards. And, you know, this was pointed out to me a few years ago. You've got this little a little thing on your card, haven't you? I don't know if it's on here. But you've got I think it's like three or four waves on the card that tell you it's a contactless card. No one ever asked me if I wanted a contactless card. But those waves, if you look at the news stories about when they were first testing out contactless payment, there were people who were walking past a Marks and Spencer's. I'm not sure where it was, but anyway, it's a great article about it. And they were finding that money was disappearing off of their card into the terminals in the shop. So why can't we have a panorama about this, please? Yeah, why? That's theft, isn't it? Also, double payments being taken sometimes with you getting no receipt, this kind of thing. So we're moving towards the point where you've got to have... And has anyone been on the London buses recently over the last year or so? Yeah, right. Well, you know, you can't actually pay with cash anymore in London. You can't... You know, you can give the guy £1.50, he won't take it. You know, well, maybe some will, and say, carry on. But... So we're going over to either you have your Oyster card or you've got to have your chip and PIN card. Actually, I managed to get I've got a thing called an Electron card. I managed to find that the Co-op Bank, actually, you don't have to have a contactless card. You can have an Electron card, and that's what I've got. But I can't use it to pay on the London buses. Yeah. But anyway, so we're moving towards a system where everybody has got to have a what do you call these little digital RFID radio frequency identification chip. So whether it's in your Oyster card or whether it's in your contactless payment card, you can't get on a bus without an RFID chip. But again, you see, this is a whole world which isn't not really being looked at by the financial press, is it? You know, have you seen this in the Mail on Sunday, whatever? They haven't really looked at it because it's something which has been decided from on high we are going to do. And I find it, you know, pretty chilling that's the direction that they seem to be wanting to take us down. I suppose the most dangerous part of all that, never mind all the surveillance, people watching everything you're spending, everything you're doing, is actually much more to do with being able to switch you off. Yeah, so you're in the middle of wherever it is, you're doing something and suddenly, boom, you can't do anything. The chip doesn't. Whatever. Nothing will work for you. So, you know, we've had all this over the last couple of years, haven't we? More and more news stories of, oh, we're very sorry the cash point doesn't work. Oh, we're very sorry your money hasn't got into your account from Barclays and other big banks. So that's another whole area which has been completely changed by the whole digital money, the whole digital world. Moving on to another story, which is again completely taboo, is this guy here. Has anyone heard of him? Alexander Litvinenko, who wrote this book here called Blowing Up Russia. Blowing Up Russia is he's the guy who died of polonium poisoning. He was given a cup of tea with radioactive polonium in it, and he slowly died over a couple of weeks in a London hospital. And there's just been a trial in London, some sort of show trial, because none of the people who were supposed to give evidence actually turned up. And the Queen's Counsel, the QC for the government, was the same guy I met when I was doing a data protection thing about MI5 years ago, and he was stood against me, and I mean, he was hopeless, basically. He was ruffling through his papers, and he couldn't find stuff. But anyway, so Litvinenko is Putin's sort of darkest secret, in a way, that they don't like to think about or talk about on Russia Today, or in Russia, because Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, is really about how Putin came to power. Because around about, I'm talking about the late 1990s, there was every chance in Russia that the Communist Party would come back to power. And they were starting to, because what had happened is the usual thing is privatization of everything. All these oligarchs had gotten hold of all big Russian industries. They were starting to make a fortune out of it. And the communists were doing very well. Anyway, Putin came along, and because he'd done a deal with some of these oligarchs to do with the Chechen War. He wanted to get the Chechen, a bit like Margaret Thatcher, came to victory again on the back of the Falklands crisis. So it looks as if Putin, according to Litvinenko's book, Putin was involved in blowing up apartment buildings in Moscow and Ryazan in order to blame that on the Chechens and start the Chechen War. So that whole story is almost, you're not allowed to talk about that. Because the thing is, it also starts to raise people's consciousness that maybe our government is doing this kind of thing too. Maybe if there's a bomb that goes off in wherever, you know, in Cardiff or something, or in Bristol, that might actually be done by our own people rather than by some sort of enemy or Al-Qaeda or whatever, because they've been doing this for decades. If anyone has ever heard of Operation Gladio, which is NATO's own program, mostly during the 1970s and 1980s, basically running things like the Red Brigades in Italy, blowing up things in Italy and then blaming it on the Red Brigades when actually it was fascist groups that were doing the explosions. The Oktoberfest, there was a bomb in Germany, which was blamed on German far left, which actually turned out to be a fascist group in Germany that had done it with the knowledge of the secret services in Germany. But most of this stuff was run by NATO. Operation Gladio, if you've never come across it, have a look, and you'll see that there's been innocent Europeans been blown up by NATO. And NATO intelligence services working with these stay-behind fascist groups for decades. And so that really puts... That's one of the reasons. I mean, I didn't know this when I first started looking into the London bombings, but it all starts to make sense to me now. I mean, in Bologna Railway Station in 1980, 85 people were blown up by fascists, and they tried to blame it on the Red Brigades, the lefties, saying, oh, they're working with the Russians. But nobody actually, after a few weeks and a few decent police investigation into it, they realised there was nothing to do with the Red Brigades. They even kidnapped a former Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, and killed him. And tried to blame that on the Red Brigades. It was actually all being orchestrated from behind the scenes. So these sorts of things are minefield subjects. And of course, if you start getting into that on Russia Today, I think they're going to close you down fairly quick. They don't really want you talking to the world about how Putin blew up Russia, blew up Moscow and Ryazan, just like potentially, anyway, Western powers were behind things like the London bombings and September 11th attacks. Another one has got to be the death of Diana. I think probably because it goes to the heart of the establishment here. All I will say about that, I mean, probably most people here, I would imagine, are sceptical about whether that was really an accident. Again, with the CCTV, there's all sorts of other reasons. But there's a guy called John Morgan in Australia, an investigative journalist retired, who's kind of come out of retirement. And he's written a book called The Paris-London Connection, which is a very good, short introduction to all the facts that are known about the Diana killing. And it's almost certain. I mean, yeah, obviously it's very difficult to be 100% certain on these things. But, I mean, when the first paramedics arrived at the scene, Diana was given a 13 out of 14 on the health scale. So basically they would go around to all of the people that looked like they'd been affected by it and find out who there were priorities to treat. Diana was at the bottom of the list. She was fine. She was breathing, talking, whatever, you know. So the idea that she was dead within an hour, you know, on the way to hospital in the ambulance. But anyway, that's another one which, you know, for me is quite important. But I think if you're talking about George Orwell, I mean, you know, I've got some of the people here on the George Orwell quote, this one about he who controls the present controls the past and all that. Probably the biggest one of those things that's hit me, really since this time last year, is the emergence of ISIS as a force in the Middle East. What is ISIS really all about? Or ISIL or IS, whoever the people calling it? Because when that first happened, I just thought, this is amazing that Orwell should be so clever to predict this kind of thing. If you read 1984, you'll see in there you've got National Hate Week, where Big Brother is giving some big speech. But of course, he's just, you know, a front man, and the organisation behind the scenes has decided, well, actually, we're not at war with this continent anymore. We're at war with that continent. And so they go and they change the speech halfway through, even changing the banners of people in the crowd who are waving banners. We hate such and such a place. So National Hate Week, and that's exactly what ISIS was happened with ISIS. In the middle of the week, we're told, well, the beginning of the week, we're told that the Syrian rebels are our friends, that they're trying to topple this evil dictator Assad, that we're supplying them with intelligence information, trucks, this kind of thing. By the end of the week, they're the devil themselves, and they're evil, and we must stop them. How are we going to stop them? I couldn't quite believe that the Western power structure, the ruling classes or the elite, the military, the government, etc., would be so blatant as to change. You know, these are, one minute they're the good guys, next minute they're the bad guys. We had an announcement, I think, a few weeks ago, that the good Syrian rebels, well, they only ever could find 80 of them in the whole of the Middle East. So what was this all about? Most recently, I think it was last week, one of the top retired US intelligence people from the Defense Intelligence Agency said it was a willful thing to create ISIS. And this is from the top of the... I think, in a way, these are the most credible sources. And this is, again, it's a minefield subject. We haven't had this on the Channel 4 News. We haven't had this on the BBC News, that the senior American military are saying ISIS was willfully created by the Pentagon. We aren't seeing that, are we? But I think many people here realise that's the way things are working over there, that these kinds of organisations... I mean, they talked about it as a honeypot, didn't they, at the beginning, saying, or at least some commentators, saying, well, this is to attract all the nutters that we can then use them. Effectively, it's an attack on Syria, part two. So a really good example, I think, ISIS, of Orwell getting things right. How are we doing for time? Okay, well, I'll just try and wind up with a few more positive things to say. I think we're in a really interesting situation in economics. Did anyone been following what's been going on in Greece and Yanis Varoufakis, this guy who turns up on a motorbike and sort of talks like we do, you know, amazing to see him at the top of Greek politics. He's articulated a lot of stuff. I mean, particularly the blogs he did after he left. He was sacked, I think, or he was moved or whatever, or resigned from becoming Greek finance minister. He did a brilliant blog post which was about what his reaction or how his meetings had gone with the Troika, what are now called, I think, the Eurozone, aren't they? They change their name every 5 minutes. But this is effectively the European Central Bank. Remember, in the background, you've got the IMF saying, you know, that there needs to be some kind of remitting the debt in Greece. But no, the Eurozone is saying, or the Euro group is saying no. And he was basically saying, well, I was trying to have discussions with these officials, particularly with the German guy at the European Central Bank, and it was just like you hadn't spoken. If you start to use economic arguments with them, they're not interested in that. And that's the sort of thing that we're getting now, with our debate being closed down. So we've got something new, and it's called Corbynomics. It's quite an interesting phenomenon in Britain, and I think what's happening is we've got a situation here which could be actually wonderful for the country, because you've got a whole load of academics. I mean, I don't know how many people follow alternative economics or so-called non-mainstream. Actually, this is perfectly good and sensible stuff. There's a guy called Steve Keen who wrote Debunking Economics, which is a terrific book, and he's a, you know, really nice guy. I think he's at Kingston University. He's quite poor, you know, he doesn't get all these like bursaries and get taken all around the world, but he talks loads of sense about economics. He's talked about what he believes needs to be a Copernican revolution in economics. That is to say, at the moment, all the academics, all the journalists are stuck in a rut where they haven't realized that the Earth is orbiting the sun. They still think the sun is orbiting the Earth, yeah? So there's something completely wrong. And the reason they've got all this wrong is pretty simple, really. It's because they treat all of the financial institutions like Barclays and the LIBOR fixers and the investment banking world as neutral, not having an influence on any of the equations that they use, right? Which, of course, is complete bunkum. They have a massive amount of influence, the discretion about who they lend to and who they don't lend to, a bit like the police, the discretion about who they prosecute and who they don't prosecute, or the Crown Prosecution Service. So, you know, there's a massive amount of politics involved in the financial system. And what Jeremy Corbyn has been saying, and he's brought some of these people right into his campaign, some of the best economists in the world, actually, is they're saying really basic stuff, which is things like, we had a £375 billion bailout in 2008, but it's not actually been spent on us, it's been spent on the rich, and effectively what it's been doing, it's been pumping up all this QE money, it's been pumping up share prices, and it's been pumping up asset prices. So anyone that's got a large amount of property or shares, they've been doing really nicely out of all of this. And if you think back to 2008, people talk about it as a crash. Rubbish, it's not a crash, it wasn't a crash. 1929 was a crash. The one that's coming, potentially, that may be a crash, but it was a bailout, it wasn't a crash, and the bailout was done to avoid a crash. So don't talk about it. You see Robert Pestle on the BBC, the crash of 2008, no, it's not a crash. Yeah, you'd know about it if it was, because you know, we'd been in a similar situation we were in the early 1930s, like with mass unemployed movement and Wal Hannington and the communists and people like that. But this whole business of the bailout that happened in 2008, to me, it's just blatantly obvious. And what Corbyn's saying is that money that was spent on propping up the system is actually much better spent on public services. And also, you're in this other situation where who is printing the money, right? Because QE is printing money. Who is doing the printing? Is it the private banking sector that the government's then going to and saying, please, thank you very much, we're going to borrow this money and we'll owe you it as a debt? Or is it the Bank of England? Is it the government printing the money itself? So there's all sorts of ways now in which Corbynomics is starting to question some of the fundamental idiocy of the financial gobbledygook that we get fed every day, as if it's some kind of fact on the news. Government, isn't the government going to borrow this money, or is the government going to print it? Why is it borrowing it? Why isn't it printing it? So there's two levels to this. And why aren't they spending it on us? Why are they spending it on propping up asset prices? If you go to the other key thing about 2008 to understand is what happened there was there were two groups of people that got bailed out. Number one were the investors in the banks, right? So the shareholders of the banks were bailed out. I'm not a shareholder in a bank. I don't know if anyone else here is, but those were the people who were helped by the bailout. The other group are those who've got bank accounts with more than the guaranteed amount that the government will pay you if the bank goes bust. So I think, isn't it about 20 grand or something? So anyone that's got more than 20 grand was helped by the bailout. So really, it was purely money going to the super rich and the rich. And they're not helping out ordinary people at all as part of that. Finally, I mean, because it'd be nice to have some questions. Finally, one of the things that's really annoyed me, and it's, you know, smacks to me of mind control, is the BBC emailing all their staff to say they're not allowed to play on the radio Neil Young or The Doors. Now that was only a little tiny story in the Guardian, but it does give you an indication of what on earth is going on at the BBC. You're not allowed to play The Doors. You're not allowed to play Light My Fire or you know, one of the classics from Neil Young. Interestingly enough, Neil Young has just brought out an album which is a whole section of is anti-Monsanto. But what they're saying is it's to do with copyright. So the BBC is now, you know, it's not perfect, but it's becoming an instrument where the powerful now think, well, we can tweak this and tweak that, and they're using it to control what we can see and hear. So organisations of alternative media are becoming more and more important, and also, of course, foreign channels and maybe the possibility of getting documentaries on those, because that has opened up as a massive new... Tim Tate, for example, I talked about earlier, used to work for World in Action. He's now working for doing documentaries for Al Jazeera. He finds that, you know, he'll put a proposal to the BBC or Channel 4 and they say no. The Al Jazeera, great, this is perfect, brilliant. And this is where people have come to him with whistleblowing material about big international stories. So there are alternatives out there. Finally, before we do some questions, I'll just say, please, I mean, everybody in a way is a little journalist, even if you write a diary or do a blog or even chat to people. So I would say always carry a notebook, right, which I always try and do. I mean, sometimes I do, but because sometimes you could be out in the middle of nowhere and you just suddenly have a really good idea, write it down. Because at some point you'll think, now, what was that? Oh, hang on. But it's a really good and important way, I think, to just capture thoughts when you suddenly have, you're in a moment of clarity. Don't let that moment of clarity go, because that's what they want. What they're doing is they're effectively dumbing down an entire population. They're supposed to be educating us, but they're not doing that. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Let's have some questions.
Thanks very much, Tony. And we've got questions, if anyone's got any for... Yeah.
Thanks very much. Just on the subject of Orwell a bit more. I remember him writing, I read a book, I didn't remember him, writing that about, he was always attacking journalists for dumbing down themselves. So the story on the first day would be very detailed, and by day three it would be just really simplified and it would be real headline tabloid, sort of what we would now call clickbait. And that was in 1938 he was writing about this trend of, and I think he was more about how we've got such a low ability to keep our concentration up on a topic, and that's not about the journalists, that's about us as the consumers of those stories, and I think that's actually the biggest problem that we face with all this stuff, is we move on very quickly.
Well, the one thing that keeps us separate from the animals is our ability to use language and to communicate around the world. I mean, I don't want to get too much into that, but it does seem to be a completely separate thing. We've got this ability with language as creatures, and we've really got to use it, and we've got to find a way of making sure that when we're getting that language, they're getting that information, that it's trustworthy. Back in the old days, to a large extent, the unions used to play a large part in that, in making sure that the owners of the transmitters, the owners of the printing presses, couldn't interfere. But with this is one of the products of Murdoch, I'm afraid. Also, I mean, Orwell, just generally, was because I worked with George Monbiot back in the 1990s on the Land Is Ours campaign. And, you know, it's funny, but he was kind of on the spine of history, Orwell, in some amazing way, because one of the people that came to speak there was Michael Foot, who was the former leader of the Labour Party, and he came to speak about in 1999 at the Diggers' anniversary, the 350th anniversary of Gerard Winstanley and the Civil War, and Michael Foot actually brought out a copy from the 1940s of Gerard Winstanley's writings. Which was quite a rare thing in those days, because it was really other people in the 40s that, after Orwell, I suppose, had given him this, that had popularised it, people like Christopher Hill. And there he said, I've got my copy here of Gerard Winstanley, given to me by George Orwell. So in a way, you know, by connecting the land rights struggles we've had over the centuries, another taboo is that actually King Charles I was ending enclosure in the 1630s. He'd actually stopped it completely. I mean, there was a battle going on between the aristocracy and the merchant classes in those days. And that's another taboo. It's very difficult to get that information out to people to make them understand. Well, Winstanley didn't know the details, but he was absolutely right that enclosure was the issue in the Civil War and who was going to own the land. Was it going to be, you know, was it going to be some kind of collective, you know, it's a gift, free gift to mankind, isn't it? How can you own this stuff, you know? And I think, yeah, so... Yeah, Orwell was also wrote some brilliant stuff, obviously, about the Spanish Civil War. So he was connected in with all the Nazi stuff. And, it would have been nice to talk about the Nazis in South America at some point, but because there are two books. I mean, I thrive on good books, right? And these two here, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. He's a former CBS guy in World War II. And Op JB by Christopher Crichton. He was in Special Forces in the war. This gives the, shall we say, the European and the British angle, and this gives the South American angle on what happened with the Nazis. But I'll just leave it at that, you know, because basically their deals were done. Nazis went over to South America and they created a whole financial empire, 750 companies over in South America, that, you know, some of which we're still having to deal with today.
Tony, quick one. A lot of us are really worried about release of genetically modified organisms in farming. And there's been so-called debates on the BBC, but they never really actually put the worrying side. They always gloss it over. Do you know why?
Well, yes, you have to look at who's really running the BBC nowadays. I mean, now you've got Rona Fairhead as the chairman. I mean, I'm not saying, I mean, this has been happening for the succession over the years has been Chris Patton as chairman. Rona Fairhead now, she's still on the risk committee of HSBC. So you're looking at the criminals, effectively a criminal elite now running the BBC. Why I say that is because HSBC was done for money laundering, massive scale. They were working with Mexican drug cartels. They were even adapting HSBC banks in Mexico to allow suitcases full of money to come into the bank, this kind of thing. So Rona Fairhead was on the risk committee at HSBC. So she's the person who's assessing, you know, what's the risk here? Should we do it or shouldn't we do it, right? Now, obviously, those would be confidential minutes, but she's part of that elite. And I think that's the problem, is the criminal elite have realised that journalism has to be owned, taken over, controlled. Now, there are a lot of good people still trying to do stuff in the BBC, and it's good it's still there, because they do get the truth out from time to time, like the Panorama documentary I was telling you about loyalists in Northern Ireland, but they're not able to deal at all with current events. The only place you'll find the truth out about things like Charlie Hebdo attacks, etc., is on the internet. You got another question over there?
Well, okay, it will have to be a really, really quick one, okay? So,
It was just in continuation of the Rona Fairhead comment. I mean, fact, under tribunal, they've admitted to laundering $53 billion. They were fined 1.4. When Rona Fairhead is asked, as the head of the BBC Trust, whether she's got anything to answer for, as head of due diligence on the checks that you're referring to with the Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico and the Saudi government, you know, she said, no, I don't have a claim to answer. Do you think that there's any position for the public to be able to ask a public representative whether she should be made to answer questions?
Well, I don't know, because do the BBC really listen to questions anymore that the public ask? Can they really call them to account? I think we're in a situation where only really the media themselves, like Channel 4 News, actually did quite a good interrogative interview with her, and possibly in Parliament at the Culture Select Committee, that sort of place, those questions need to be asked. But the MPs need to be furnished with the information to do that. Effectively, the other media is very, very bad at criticising other media. Say, for example, in Bristol, we very rarely get one of the media outlets like the BBC criticising the local newspaper. Even if there's a terrible thing that the local paper has done, the BBC says, well, we don't want to upset them, you know. So I'm afraid we're getting to the situation where, Britain hasn't Britain always been a bit of an oligarchy? I think it has. but it's becoming formalized as basically a mafia oligarchy at the top. I mean, your question provokes a bit of crystal ball gazing as well, which is where are we going with all this? Yeah, if Rona Fairhead can be put in charge of the BBC when she's part of a criminal elite, and she's actually, yeah, and she's being prosecuted in the US, by the way, as well, for all this money laundering. And to me, it seems the only way this is going to end up is some kind of civil war, another kind of civil war, because if you've got the mafia running things, rather than the mafia as, you know, usually any kind of decent organisation or a business or a company can cope with a bit of organised crime around, but when the organised crime is at the top, then you're in a really serious situation, and ultimately we are their enemy, because we actually would like to see criminals behind bars, please.
Thanks very much, Tony. Everyone, thanks very much to Tony Gosling.